Sam Plant on the line here at thecommentary.ca. John Doyle is the Globe and Mail's television critic. He's written the daily television column since 2000 and has been with the paper since 1997. Before that, he wrote for their television magazine. If you've been reading him this week, he's in town to talk to television makers in these parts and on the state of production and so forth. He's also got out now the paperback version of his wonderful 2005 memoir, A Great Feast of Light, Growing Up Irish in the Television Age, published by Anchor. The soft cover retails for $22. This is a great book, beautifully written, and a favorite of mine. I am pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program John Doyle. Good morning, Mr. Doyle.
Good morning, and thank you very much for your nice remarks about the book.
The one thing that I really liked about the book, and unfortunately I've never traveled very much, and I've never been to Europe, or to Ireland for that matter, the town that you grew up in, Nina, that's how you pronounce it, correct?
Yes, it's pronounced Nina, like the girl's name.
You paint such a wonderful portrait of that town, flaws and all. The people of Nina, did they agree with your opinion of them, of the city?
Well, it's a good question. Some did and some didn't. There were many people who had left Nina over the years, who had grown up there, as I did, but had left the town, often much later than I did. I left when I was, about 10 years old, but I encountered people who had grown up in Nina and then had gone on from there to university or to take a job in Dublin or indeed to emigrate to the U.S. or Canada, and they tended to agree with the portrait I give of the town, of it being a small town that was encumbered with snobbery and a strict sense of hierarchy. People who are still living in Nina today and were there when I was growing up, some of those reacted with not so much anger, but I think just dismay that the town was portrayed negatively. In fact, one person who wrote about it in one of the local publications in the Nina area described it as not so much a memoir as semi-fiction, because they simply didn't agree with the portrait of the town.
You said that there were a number of you that had left, and a number that had stayed. Is it a great portion of you that left Nina, that left that part of Ireland, and went elsewhere?
Well, emigration was almost constant in Ireland from the time of the Great Famine in the middle of the 19th century up until the 1980s, actually. Emigration was the sort of safety valve for the society in the Republic of Ireland. Remember that Ireland was a very much a Catholic society that adhered in the main to traditional views on things like contraception, divorce, and related things. So there was always a high youth population in Ireland. It was common when I was growing up for there to be families of five children, often seven or eight children. And a small country of Ireland's size and fairly minuscule wealth in those days, and essentially used immigration as a safety valve. There weren't enough jobs for people. People left mainly to the United Kingdom. Later, when Ireland joined the European Union, to other parts of Europe, often to the United States or Canada. So Nina would be typical of small town Ireland in that a majority of its youthful population left in their late teens or into their 20s.
It's been a couple of years since I read the book. You went to Canada. Your parents, where did they end up, and where did your siblings?
Well, my father worked for a sort of Crown Corporation, Irish Life Assurance Company, and he was transferred in his job out of Nina, the town where he had been born and grown up. When he got a promotion, he was transferred to, actually actually an even smaller town in County Leitrim in Ireland, and then later to Dublin. So my parents have lived in Dublin now for, both are still alive and in fine fettle, and they have lived in Dublin for many years. My sister, after spending some time living and working in England, is also in Dublin and lives in the heart of the city and has been there for many years.
Do you miss it at all? Do you miss Ireland, or do you? I bet you get back once in a while, correct?
Well, I have always gone back at least once a year over the 27 years I have been in Canada. When I was writing the book, I went more often to do research, to talk to my parents, to revisit places where I grew up and where I had key experiences that are described in the book. And over the last few years, as my parents have grown more elderly, I go back about every 6 months or so. And it's Ireland, well, it's always in my consciousness. But it varies, the strength of the connection with Ireland tends to vary. So I would describe it as sometimes, you know, I feel I'm tethered to Ireland by something as thin as the most thin thread, and sometimes I feel like I'm tethered to Ireland by a very strong rope. It really depends on what's happening, in Ireland, and what kind of state of mind I'm in. You ask me if I miss it. There are certain aspects of Ireland I do miss, and I think all Irish people who leave it do miss. That is the sense of fun that Irish people have, the love of language they have, the wit of Irish people is profound and always entertaining. I also at times miss the sense of the importance of the arts and the writer in society that you find in Ireland. Ireland has great respect for its writers and artists, and gives them a privileged place in society. It also is a place that has a great respect for the past, and there are times when, you know, living in Toronto, or just living in Canada, I notice the vast difference in attitudes about things like that, and that would be one of the things I would miss.
You grew up in a Catholic school, and there's one scene in the book that stayed with me ever since I first read it. I guess it must have been a couple of years now since the book came out. Brother Spellacy, is that how you pronounce it?
Spellacy, yes.
he says to your class, I can't remember now exactly why, but the quote stays with me. It says, "Every one of you is bound for the wheelbarrow and the shovel."
Yes.
And it won't be a pen that one of you is using, but a shovel. Using for work, but a shovel. Did that affect you in any way because you're a writer now?
I'm not sure it affected me directly, I think, in the sense you mean, because what Brother Spellacy was doing, as almost all school teachers did back then in the 1960s in Ireland, was try to educate the youth to be middle class. Ireland was still very much a post-colonial society, and class mattered a great deal. And teachers took it as their role to try to remind their pupils that though they may be working class, and their parents may be, you know, their father might be a laborer who literally worked with a wheelbarrow and a shovel, that the way forward was for people to aspire to be middle class, to wear a suit to work, and use a pen, whether you were working as a file clerk, or as a lawyer, it was better to be someone in a suit in an office with a pen and pencil, rather than be someone who was using a wheelbarrow and a shovel to do laboring work.
When, because you were, I know people, your family members and people in where you lived used to make fun of you because you weren't an outdoorsy type. You weren't out playing with a stick or a ball. You were always reading or watching television. Where were the seeds sown that you were to be a writer?
There are multiple number of reasons, and I don't think I could put my finger on one as being the sole or the main reason, but certainly one of the things that I think that, you know, emerges in the book is that because my parents were obliged to move around because of my father's job, I had to learn to adapt to new situations, new school, new neighborhood, new set of friends, new set of potential friends, and that made me an observer, that made me somebody who was obliged to observe, to size up the situation in order to learn how to fit in. And I think that's one of the skills that any writer needs to have, is to observe and to learn to absorb the atmosphere around him, to size up the situation, to be able to retain a sense of who you are and what you need to do to fit, in order to fit in. It's about observation, and I think that sense of being a good observer certainly helped make me a journalist. And because I was obliged to concentrate on these things when I was a child, it made me a writer in that I was able to write this book.
Television obviously affected your life. Why didn't I guess you got your first TV when, in 1962?
Yes.
Television had come to Ireland when, the year before?
That year, in 1962, actually.
Why had it taken so long, I guess, because TV had been in North America since, you know, the late 40s. Was it just because of the religious influence?
Well, the first thing to remember is that Ireland was remote. I mean, it is geographically remote as it stands. It's a small island off the, you know, north coast of Europe, really, with, you know, the island of Britain standing between Ireland and the mainland of Europe. It was a poor country, so the government was not about to invest in the technology of television. When there were schools to be built, there were factories to be subsidized, that sort of thing. And I suppose nobody had the sense that Ireland could be a viable place for commercial television, so nobody was going to do that. And in those days, certainly Ireland was typical of Europe in that television meant something that was state-owned or state-controlled. What happened, what really is that as soon as television became popular in Britain, people on the east coast of Ireland realized that if they bought a television set and they had an aerial on the roof, many of them could pick up the signal from the BBC or from ITV in England. And what spurred the Irish government to create the Irish Television Service was the fear that the British influence would become dominant through this new technology of television. So Ireland sort of rushed into television technology in the early 1960s because of that.
The opposition to television by religious leaders and some political leaders, was that before television had come, or was that after they'd seen what was on TV?
Oh, it was very much afterwards. One of the quotations that, you know, I use in the book, which has gone into legend in Ireland, is that of a member of the Irish Parliament, a man named Oliver J. Flanagan, who was famous for his religious piety, and he, in speaking in Parliament one day, worked himself up into a lather of indignation about the lurid things that he was witnessing on Irish television, and having gathered himself up into an extraordinary state of agitation, he concluded by saying, "There was no sex in Ireland before television." But it's a foolish remark and has become legendary because of its foolishness. But I think it's in hindsight it's a very interesting remark, because of course he couldn't literally mean there was no sex in Ireland before television, but what he meant was that nobody was talking about sex. And it really, you know, in terms of television and the importance of television, what he was talking about still holds true today. Television is the water cooler medium. It is what people gather to talk about at work the next day around the water cooler. And so Oliver J. Flanagan was really talking about the fact that television was actually giving people ideas about a different way of life than they had in traditional Catholic conservative Ireland. So television was compelling people to talk about matters related to sex.
And it was quite dramatic, the effect that television had on the society. You talk about it, and I don't know why this strikes me as peculiar or interesting, but the effect on it, it really did alter the society a great deal, that the Ireland that you grew up with is dramatically different than that today.
Yes, it is. It is dramatically different today, and one of the reasons I wrote the book is that, over the last two decades, it has become a cliché among historians and sociologists writing about changes in Irish society to say that television had an enormous impact, but nobody had actually written about how that happened and described the way it happened. One of the things I cite in the book is an Irish talk show slash variety show called The Late Late Show, which was an in-studio show made in Dublin with a studio audience. There would be guests. Sometimes they would be politicians, priests, bishops, important people. Sometimes they would simply be entertainers. But often the emphasis was on issues of the day. And one of the extraordinary things that happened with The Late Late Show and with television in general in Ireland is that when Irish people went on television, and this happened perhaps because the technology was new, but when they were in a television studio and they were given the opportunity to ask questions of a government minister or somebody like a popular priest or a bishop or somebody in authority in the church, they would actually question them. They would actually argue with them. They would say things that they might be reluctant to say on the street outside their own home, but for some reason they were empowered to be questioning and contrary in a television studio. And The Late Late Show functioned then as a forum for the discussion of issues related to religion, to sex, to sexuality, to contraception, to divorce, abortion, all of these things that nobody really wanted to talk about in Ireland. They were talked about on The Late Late Show.
This altering of the society, is this unique to Ireland, or has this been seen elsewhere where televisions come across for the first time?
Well, my knowledge is not so wide that I could cite specific examples of other countries, but an interesting thing happened just after the book came out at the original hardback at the end of 2005. When I was writing the book, I was, as far as I was concerned, writing my story and writing an Irish story, and I was concentrating on that. A few weeks after the book was out, I began to get letters and emails from people who had read it to say that they knew I was writing about Ireland and a small town in Ireland and Ireland in the 1960s, but they felt it was their story too, because they had grown up, say, in a small town in Newfoundland or a small town in northern Ontario or a very small place somewhere on the prairies. And since the book has been published in the United States, I've had some similar mail as well from down there. So it turns out that I was writing about a sort of universal experience, especially for people in any country who are growing up in a remote place where they feel disconnected from the world at large, from the centers of power, where they feel that what they see around them in a small town or village or rural community is the only way of living. When television came, it showed them that there were other ways of life.
And Donna Reed was the first woman you ever encountered wearing pants, is that correct?
Well, certainly I mentioned that in the book because my mother and other housewives on the street in this small town in Ireland in the 1960s were certainly struck by the fact that there was this woman on television who was wearing trousers.
Besides Donna Reed, you would watch her. You also talk about Bat Masterson, the old Gene Barry show. What did that tell you about where you were growing up and what was outside of your sphere, your Ireland, I guess.
Well, like most small boys, I was at the time, certainly I was interested in Westerns, and we saw a lot of Westerns on television in Ireland in those days. Bat Masterson was a figure who struck me because he had a confidence. He was a man who was comfortable in his own skin. He had a way about him which told you that you couldn't mess with this man. He was a man of principle and wit, and he had this enormous self-confidence about him. And that was really what struck me, was that he was very different from many of the adults I saw around me.
You close the book talking about the Pope's visit, John Paul II's visit to Ireland, and you counter that with the emergence of Dallas, the mm-hmm. the Larry Hagman, Larry Hagman and others, who the primetime soap opera. Its popularity was contrary to, well, I don't know if it was contrary, but it was interesting to see the rise in the popularity of Dallas alongside this sort of rapture that had taken place when John Paul II had said Mass in was it Dublin?
Yes, well, in three places in Ireland, yes. I end the book with that because I think it encapsulates a particular time in Ireland, and it was a key moment, and it was also just before I left Ireland. 1979, John Paul II came to Ireland. It was a very important day in Ireland, the first time a pope had visited. The number of people who attended the Mass that he gave in Dublin was over a million people, which at that point was pretty much the entire population of the city of Dublin. And one of the reasons the Pope was there was to bolster the traditional conservative Catholicism that was still very much rampant in Ireland, and through the 1960s and into the 1970s, as the world changed, Ireland in many ways didn't, because of its adherence to that traditional Catholic view of things. So the Pope was there to bolster all of that. He was there for a few days, 3 days, I think. At roughly the same time, however, the show Dallas arrived on Irish television, and the Irish really, really liked Dallas as television entertainment. They liked it in part because it wasn't that different from some of the traditional ways of rural Ireland. I mean, Dallas was really about feuding families and land and oil, and that's that. If you take out the oil part of it, that was fairly typical of what you might find in rural Ireland. You know, families feuding over land. Beyond Dallas, you also had, you know, one of the central couples in it clearly didn't get along. They were separated, but they refused to divorce. That was very typical in Ireland of the time. But Dallas was also about rampant capitalism. It was about the need, the urge to make money and to use every possible route to making money. And it was a celebration of capitalism, of raw capitalism. And if you look at Ireland now, it is one of the most prosperous countries in the world. It is, in terms of its industrial output and the sheer wealth of the country, it's one of the wealthiest in Europe. And so if you look back now, and this is sort of how I conclude the book, the Pope and Dallas came at the same time, but Dallas won and the Pope lost. The Catholic Church essentially lost its grip in Ireland, and capitalism won out.
Well, who said that watching Dallas was like watching a document? If you wanted to watch a documentary in the oil business, you would watch Dallas.
Yes, I mentioned in the book as an indication of how popular Dallas was in Ireland. I was at university at that point, And it, whilst it was not cool to mention that you watched a show like Dallas, everybody did. And there was somebody at the university who finally reluctantly admitted that he watched Dallas, but that he thought he had been sort of tricked into it, because when he first watched it, he thought he was sitting down to watch a documentary about the oil business, and found he was watching a soap opera and became addicted to it.
Besides the Late Late Show, were there Irish television dramas, and were there comedies that they produced themselves?
There were a limited amount, but certainly there were. There was, I mean, in some ways, it's sort of it's a mirror image of the Canadian situation, in that there was a constant battle to get more Irish-made content on television. But there always was. There were soap operas about rural Ireland, soap operas about urban life in Dublin. There were crime dramas. There was a very popular crime drama that took place entirely in the Gaelic language, in which everybody on it spoke Gaelic, and it was set in the west of Ireland, where many people did still speak Gaelic in those days. You had a lot of documentaries, a lot of news programs, a lot of quiz shows, a lot of cheaply made programs. But they were Irish made, and they were watched by the Irish.
As a TV critic, you obviously watch a lot of TV. Incidentally, how much television do you watch a week?
Well, it varies. I don't actually watch as much as some people think. I am sent generally what happens is that I'm sent advanced copies of programs, all kinds of programs, and I'm one of the few critics who really just says send me everything. You know, whether it's a cooking show or it's a new drama, you know, I will take a look. I might find something interesting to say about it. I would watch television for, you know, maybe 2 or 3 hours a day, and also write about it. You know, 2 or 3 hours a day, Monday to Friday, and probably watch maybe another 2 or 3 hours each day on the weekend.
One of the interesting things about this book and about your column is that you do write about television. You're obviously intellectual, but you do see some sort of these intellect snobs, you know, who look down on TV, and you don't. You think that TV has some merit, has some cultural value, even though a lot of it is crap.
Yes, a lot of it is crap, but there is a lot of television. So even when you take away, even if you acknowledge it, that there's a lot of crap, that leaves a lot of room for a lot of quality. Yes, there is a lot of snobbery about television, and one of the things I've noticed since the book came out, and I've had more contact with the literary community or the literati in Canada, is that it is often a mark of pride to say that you don't own a television, that you want to give the impression that, you know, you spend your evening reading books. I mean, I think that's simply foolish and condescending. Television is the most important medium of our time, in that it connects the world. It offers us a window on the world. It shows us ways of life that we wouldn't know about, that it can do things that no other medium can do, that, you know, television can do things better than newspapers or radio. I also think over the last 10 years or so that the kind of drama that has emerged on television, especially from the genre sort of that's defined by the HBO channel in the United States, airing dramas like The Sopranos, Six Feet Under, those are just two examples of a long list, television drama that is adult, sophisticated, and aimed at people who want to be compelled by a raw depiction of life, by serious matters of life. That sort of storytelling on television is as good as most modern literary novels.
When did you decide to write this book?
I decided to write the book, I think, in about 2002. I would write a book for them, and they seemed to be offering me total freedom to write a book. And at the time I said no, because I simply didn't have time and I needed to establish myself as the daily critic for the Globe. But then when I heard from another publisher who was sort of offering the same deal, I decided I should, and this was about a year later, I decided I should take it seriously. And when I thought about what I wanted to write about, given the fact that I ended up being a television critic, I thought the most important thing to write about was television's impact, positive impact on Ireland at the time when I was growing up.
And the photograph on the cover, this is one of the best covers I've seen in recent years. Whose idea was it to put your picture on the cover there? How old were you?
I think I'm 6 or 7 years old in that photo. It was actually a collaboration between between me and the art director at Doubleday Canada in Toronto. We were throwing around ideas, and I produced for him a number of photos of the town of Nina, of my family, that sort of thing. And one of the things you learn as a journalist is that when you're dealing with art directors, people who work with images, they very, very rarely take the advice of writers about images, because they figure that writers know about words, they don't really understand the power of images. So I suggested this, the photo they used, as one possibility. I felt it was a fairly strong possibility, and thankfully he agreed, and it is, I acknowledge it is a beautifully designed book, and I hope that all praise goes to the art director at Doubleday Canada rather than me.
Are you working on another book?
I will start working on another book this summer. Yes, it'll be a book about soccer, actually, which is a great passion of mine, and I've been lucky enough to be sent by the Globe and Mail to cover 2 World Cup tournaments and 1 European Championship over the last few years. What I plan to do is write about soccer and issues of nationalism, internationalism, ethnicity, and hopefully tell some entertaining stories about World Cup tournaments I have attended.
You know, I'm not a soccer fan, but that sounds so interesting, and I guess we'll await that book, but for now, people should pick up the paperback, and I do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today, John, and congratulations on a very fine book.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you.